Ralf Deller, and I'm responsible for the interviews which form the basis of the book Lost Voices of Cricket, which is produced by Benefactum Publishing. We're very happy for you to listen to these fascinating excerpts for free for your personal enjoyment, but please note that they are issued under copyright of Benefactum and may not be reproduced or sold without our specific permission. They give an idea of the rich seam of anecdotes in the full interviews. Take, for instance, R.E.S. Wyatt. He was Douglas Jardine's vice-captain on the infamous Bodyline tour to Australia in 1932-33. There's never a meeting between the two sides when Bodyline isn't mentioned, even more than 80 years after the event. There were several theories about how the strategy came about, mostly blaming or attributing, depending on your point of view, Jardine with hatching the plan. Bob Wyatt knew better.
There's been an awful lot of nonsense talked about that. It was never a preconceived idea. In fact, the first person to set that field was me. And I set that field at Melbourne. They play a sort of an Australian 11, I think they called it. And Douglas went away fishing and left me in charge. And it's a very, very fast wicket. And the ball got old very quickly. So the ball ceased to swing away when Harold Law was bowling. And the Australians, being mainly back-footed players, were playing the ball on the onside. And as the ball was not likely to leave the bat, I moved one slip and then another slip and then another one onto the leg side, which was to stop runs, not with any view to intimidation or anything of that sort. But Harold was burning very fast, and he wasn't very present, I admit. Occasionally he dropped one short, but very, very occasionally. And Don Bradman was obviously very worried about him. And Harold in that match was a tremendous pace. I always remember in the second innings, they only had about 200 to get to win. So I went up to Harold Arwood. And I said, "Now, Harold," I said, "you know, you've got to bowl these chaps out." I said, "If Mr. Jardine comes back and we're beaten," I said, "it'll be hell to pay." And he said, "Oh, Skipper, that's all right, I'll bowl them out." Well, now he had absolutely ideal conditions. He had the wind behind him, a slight slope at Melbourne, and it was greasy on top. And I've never seen speed like it. I was fielding the slips next to Bill Verse. I remember Bill Verse saying, "Hope to God you don't sneak one." He said, "Go straight through us." And we were only about 30 yards from the boundary, and we weren't too deep. And George Duckworth, who was about 10 yards in front, was taking him up above his head. And he said to me, "Skipper, I'd like to go 10 yards further back." He said, "If I do, I shan't be able to reach him." He said, "They're still rising." Well, I've never seen anything like any. I think we bought about three out for 17, then it rained. That was that. We frightened Don out of his life. We frightened him out and then bowled him out. And Douglas was delighted to hear about this, you see. I said, "What have I done with the field?" And he said, "That's interesting." He said, "We'll pursue the matter." That's the exact words he... And that's where the idea of Bodyline started.
You can't get it plainer than that. Bill Alley was a great character. He was Australian by birth and upbringing, but made his name as a player in England with Somerset. Bouncer, boxer, he'd done it all before he became a professional cricketer, but not even those activities prepared him for his debut as an umpire, when he was looking for something to do when he finished playing.
"I think I'll give this umpiring business a go, see? Never thinking that I'd ever become a Test match umpire. I thought that had all gone, sort of thing. I'd just go on and have a few years, sort of thing, umpiring and enjoy that," which I did again. And I had to knock the whole lot out of my mind the first match I had. Well, I'm an umpire, not a cricketer. Middlesex and Essex match at Lord's, my first match. Peter Parfitt and Murray. They all done me. John Price. They dropped their sweaters after the fourth ball, the fifth ball. They knocked the pebbles out of my hand. And at one stage, I didn't know if I was given 8, 9, 10 balls. And I put my hand out a square leg and nearly caught Freddie Titmus at square leg. And when I came off, Billy Griffiths was the secretary. He said to me, "Why didn't you catch him?" See, they had old monoclers on me. And I went then at lunchtime. John Langridge was the other umpire, a gentleman, a great player. He came over to me, he said, "You'll be all right." He said, "When you get lunchtime over..." I said, "John," I said, "you can ring my jumper out. I said, my shirt. And I said, I'm wringing wet. I was sitting at the table. I said, I can't eat that. Can't eat that. I said, I have to go in the umpire room. I said, and they come in and talk to me and talk me around. I was ready to get rid of it straight away. Because everything, your head seemed to be out here with counts and everything, see. And Parfitt, who was a devil, actually, they used to bowl five balls on one or two occasions. After five balls, they all have it made up. They walk up, mean to say it's over. And I'd think to myself, is that five or is it six? And they didn't. I didn't know if I was given five or given six. I mean, they say in one particular match at Warwickshire, David Brown, the captain, said to me, he said, how long are we having this over, Bill? Why? I said, how many have I got up to? He said, nine so far. I said, oh, well, that's over. I can honestly say I don't think in the last 10 years of my career, umpire and cricketer, that anybody, I don't care who it is, anybody's enjoyed themselves more than what I have over that period.
Bill Ali never played Test cricket for Australia, but he went on to become a respected international umpire, even after a start like that. Trevor Bailey was noted for his dour defensive batting, as well as his role as a pace bowler. He was a true all-rounder. While the crowd might not have enjoyed his slow batting, England came to rely heavily on him, and never more so than at Lord's in 1953, when he shared a fifth-wicket partnership with Willie Watson that lasted 4 hours and saved a game that appeared lost. But that wasn't the only time he defied the Australians. In 1958 in Brisbane, he scored the slowest 50 in first-class cricket and got runs off only 40 of the 426 balls he faced.
We always lost at Brisbane, but it always personally seemed to have quite a long innings there. On the other hand, of course, in one of the long innings, I had the satisfaction of hitting certainly the most valuable six of all time, which was rather ironic, because the first six, Australian businessman offered £100 for it, and I, of all people, hit it. And we had a magnificent party in Brisbane. It coincided with my birthday, after the Test match, obviously. And the following day, those of us who weren't going down to Rockhampton made our way up back to Melbourne. And we looked pretty rough. And we walked into the foyer of the Melbourne Hotel. And who should be coming out but Sir Robert Menzies, a marvellous man. Terrific speaker, very fine politician. He looked at us and he said, you boys could do with a grog. And we went up straight up to his suite and we had a couple of lagers each. But, I mean, he really was a cricket lover. I mean, he used to make sure that when the Commonwealth was a Commonwealth and they had their meeting, it was always coincided with the Lord's Test match. Oh, he loved his cricket. Marvellous man.
The incomparable Trevor Bailey. Cyril Washbrook was the Lancastrian half of one of England's best ever opening partnerships with Yorkshire's Len Hutton. As brave as they come, Washbrook went on to captain Lancashire, and while he was in post, he became a Test selector. He had played what looked like being his last Test himself in 1951, but he came back in 1956 at the age of 41. It was said that he selected himself for his return to the England side, but Washbrook told me differently.
The selectors did that. We got to a certain stage in the meeting, having a certain amount of difficulty in odd places in the team, and Gubby Allen, who was the chairman, said, we're going to talk about you now, so you better leave the room and order the beer. So I said, well, I don't think it's as serious as all that, but we lost against Australia at Lord's, and we one or two failures in the side. And so I was, no, not kicked out of the room, but asked to leave and to go and order the beer and come back in about half an hour or so, you see. So they sent for me after a time, and when I got back in the room, Gubby Allen said, we want you to play at Leeds. He said, will you play? So I said, well, you don't refuse to play for England. I still think it's not quite as bad as all that, but I'd be very happy to play. And that's how I came to be playing at Leeds in 1956. I didn't select myself, because the other selectors did it and asked me if I would play. When I went into bat, England was 17 for 3, and I shall remember that score to my dying day. unfortunately, at the other end of batting with me was that great player, Peter May. And we gradually got on top and we made a great success of it. He got out just before the end of the day. I was still there. But I had a wonderful reception from the Yorkshire crowd going out to bat in the first place, and a great reception when I came back. I might have been a Yorkshireman, you know.
Surely not.
No. No, but I mean, they were truly great. I mean, this is obviously the finest reception I've ever had, I think. But it was very nice to get to 98. I would have been pleased to get two more, but I'd been there nearly all day, and the point is that when you've batted that long, you don't care who bowls at you from the other end, you see.
How did you get out?
LBW.
Good decision?
Well, the umpire thought so. So that I'm quite satisfied, really.
As well he might have been. Alec Bedser was a wonderful bowler for Surrey in England, inseparable from his identical twin brother Eric, apart from the fact that Eric never played for England. Alec continued to be involved with the running of the English game when he stopped playing. He chaired the England selectors from 1969 to 1981, managed two tours to Australia, and was assistant manager on another. I should say that he was assistant manager to none other than His Grace the Duke of Norfolk. And while most of the actual work fell to Bedser, he had a great admiration for the Duke.
Oh, marvellous man he was. Great, great fellow he was. Of course, I got to know him very well. Obviously, you would do, wouldn't you? You lived with him for 6 months. Became great friends, we did. He was a great man. He obviously didn't do much work except to the front job. But he did many things, very kind things. He did all the time when he was there. He's such a nice man, he was. A real gentleman. What I call a true gentleman. I used to get a car and drive him around, of course, because he didn't know any of the Australian people. He didn't know his way around at all there. So I got a car. I used to take him to the races, which was good. I enjoyed that. I loved going to the races, and, of course, going with him, you got the best treatment. And I remember we were going to Flemington one day. That was to the Melbourne Cup. I was taking him out to the Melbourne Cup. And on the way out, I said, it's a funny thing. I said, this is my fifth Melbourne Cup, it was then. I said, there's five times I've been here to the Melbourne Cup, I said, and I only live 10 miles from Ascot. I said, I've never been to Ascot, and I've never seen the Derby. So he said, would you like to come to Ascot? I said, I'd love to. He said, I'll send you some tickets. So that was November 62. In April, Eric and I went down and stayed at Arundel with him. Used to go down the weekends and stay with him. And we were sitting having a cup of tea one day, and he said, oh, by the way, he said, you want to come to Ascot? And he said, yeah, I'd love to. So he said, I'll send you the tickets. So we go home and the tickets don't come. We thought he's too busy to do it. So a week before the Ascot, these tickets arrived, registered envelope with them. I've still got them at home now. They're Mauve tickets, they were. Queen's Car Park, Queen's Enclosure, the lot. And he sent us those tickets for 7 years, he did. That was just one little gesture. He was a great man, he was.
Even Alec Bedser's enjoyment of horse racing was nothing compared to that of Colin Ingleby McKenzie, the man who led Hampshire to their first county championship title in 1961. His love of the turf was legendary, and there were numerous stories about how he would get out to hear commentary on a big race, or how he'd ask for a new pair of gloves. That, of course, contained the result of a race in which he had a financial interest. But surely those tales couldn't possibly be true, could they?
They're all absolutely true, Ralph. Of course they are. Oh, heavens, yes. I conducted myself on the field to the maximum of self-control and discipline. But I must confess my mind did certainly wander on occasions. And I think it's important that I kept an interest in what was going on outside, because in a long day in the field you need a little bit of distraction to, otherwise you get so bogged down that you can't, you know, you get interlocked into what is going on without a little bit of outside music. And secondly, I think that the team rather enjoyed, at least I hope they enjoyed, that the idea that one did have an interest in the horses. I tried to lead them on the sticky path, to disaster, but most of them were pretty sensible. But I think that I did encourage some of them to realize that it was fun, that racing was fun, and that actually to place the odd wager was quite exciting. I tried to get Derek Shackleton in his benefit match, funnily enough, when there wasn't a great crowd, to put some of the take when we were down at Bournemouth in his benefit match on a horse called Time and Again. And it won at 100-8, but I'm afraid old Shack, even I couldn't persuade Shack to part with some money to put on this horse. But he regretted it afterwards, but laughed.
Was being something of a gambler a help to you in captaincy?
I think that you need to be. I don't say you want to be a gambler, but I think you want to be able to, particularly today, you know, relate the odds of what you're doing. I think that nowadays, captains, you need to know the numbers. You need to have an element of the gambling instinct in you. And we certainly, when we won the championship, we won, I think, 19 matches out of 32. An enormous number of them were on declarations. Now, it wasn't certainly all my brilliant question mark moments of declaration, because I had lots of help from the dressing room with sort of flags being thrown out of the window. But we certainly were lucky, and during those matches you certainly have to be able to equate the odds during these matches, and that makes for perhaps somebody who has, you know, is more accustomed to the gambling element, the nervous system, and to be able to sort of know what the odds are during, particularly in the last hour or half an hour of a match.
Well, it worked for Ingleby McCrackers, as he styled himself. We mentioned a Lancashire-Yorkshire partnership opening the batting for England with great success, and there was a similar opening bowling partnership as well, in the shape of Brian Statham and Fred Truman. The Lancastrian half, Statham, was less flamboyant, but no less effective. But back at the start, he hadn't seen much first-class cricket when he made his Lancashire debut at Old Trafford against Kent.
I always remember Cyril Washbrook, as we were walking down onto the ground. We lost the toss, so we were in the field. And I remember Cyril saying, this chap Arthur Fagg, whatever you do, don't bowl short to him. He's one of the finest hookers playing, and if you bowl short at him, he'll hook you out of sight. So I said, oh, thank you very much. So away we go, and I started bowling and dropped one short to this bloke, tried to hook it, and it was a little quicker than he thought and hit the splice, and he was caught out mid-wicket by Alan Wharton. So Cyril comes strolling across whilst the other batsman was coming in. He said, I thought I told you not to bowl short to Arthur Fagg. I said, yes, but you didn't tell me who Arthur Fagg was. And I'd really no idea. I'd no idea of any of the players. I really didn't even know the players I was playing with, never mind the players I was playing against.
It wasn't long before everyone had heard of Brian Statham. Another legend who remembered his county debut clearly was Dennis Compton, the sporting idol of post-war Britain. He made his first-class debut before the war, and then went on to truly great things in both cricket and football. But for him, the greatest memory was that 1936 match when he appeared for Middlesex for the first time. Here he was, playing against and alongside his boyhood heroes. So, did he feel a sense of awe?
There was a feeling of awe, yes. I mean, it was a wonderful feeling for me to think that I was actually playing against cricketers who, they were my idol when I was a schoolboy. I loved it, and of course, I suppose the greatest thrills ever, even to the end of my career, was being selected for my first match for Middlesex against Sussex at the Whitsuntide, and I was picked as a bowler, and I batted number 11. And I know we wanted something like 30 to secure first innings lead, which is very important in those days, and I arrived at the wicket, and of course the other end with me was the great Sir Gubby Allen, and we made the 30 runs. And I never forget, we got what we wanted, and I was given out LBW, and an umpire called Bill Reeves, who was a wonderful character indeed, gave me out. And I remember Gubby turning to him and saying, oh, Bill, you are a bloody cheat. That little boy wasn't LBW. He said, oh, I know, sir, he said, but he's going to be okay. But I was dying for a wee.
Dennis Compton went into the media when he finished playing, while Doug Insole went into cricket administration, where he made an even greater impact on the game than he did in his playing career with Essex and England. It was when he was chairman of selectors that he had to pick the side to go to South Africa in 1968. Basil D'Oliveira was not welcome in the apartheid-ridden land of his birth, but he threw the cat among the pigeons by scoring a magnificent century against Australia at the Oval just before the selection was made. But he didn't make the touring party, with Tom Cartwright getting the nod. Cartwright had been injured, so did the selectors get assurances that he'd be fit to tour?
Indications, yes. I mean, physio said they thought he'd be okay. Tom was a fine bowler. I mean, he's the best medium pacer in this country and probably anywhere. And in South Africa, well, he would have been terrific. But anyway, I went up to see him at Edgbaston and he said, well, I couldn't be sure that I'd be able to go through the tour. And, well, he withdrew virtually, yeah.
And then you were faced with finding a replacement. There were people like Barry Knight, Ray Illingworth were around, weren't they? And
Barry Knight was barred by MCC from being selected. Ray Illingworth wasn't available, nor was Ted Dexter, nor was Bob Barber, nor was Ken Higgs. I remember those names very well. Basil had been getting wickets for Worcester, top of their bowling averages, hadn't scored a run until the Oval. But he was on the reserve list and he just slotted in when Tom dropped out. But yeah, that's a big problem. They, you know, turn up from time to time.
Doug Insole bringing us to the end of these samples of the memories of some great names of cricket. I felt privileged to be able to interview them, and I hope you'll enjoy reading the book and maybe wanting to hear the full interviews. Both the book and the original interviews are available through the Benefactum website at www.beni-factum.co.uk.